Support for WPR comes from Isthmus Partners, an independent asset management firm offering comprehensive financial planning and tailored investment solutions for clients nationwide. More at isthmuspartnersllc.com. Support for WPR comes from Rutabaga Paddle Sports, offering canoes, kayaks, and advice to experience solitude on Wisconsin waterways. With test paddling at 2620 Rimrock Road in Madison. RutabagaShop.com.
The vampires live on and cannot die by mere passing of time. A vampire can flourish when that he can fatten on the blood of the living. Even more, we have seen amongst us that he can even grow younger, that his vital faculties grow strenuous and seem as though they refresh themselves when his special pabulum is plenty. But he cannot flourish without this diet. He eats not as others. Even friend Jonathan, who lived with him for weeks, did never see him eat, never. He throws no shadow. He makes in the mirror no reflection. Conjuring a dim forested land of grim castles, howling wolves, and vampires, Irish writer Bram Stoker created a deathless classic called Dracula. He was building on legends based on the lives of people and places, and his descriptions have continued to shape our image of Serbs and the Balkan region of southeastern Europe. I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. How do vampires continue to get into the bloodstream of Western culture? With me is Tomislav Lakinovich, professor of Slavic and comparative literature at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, professor emeritus. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you very much, Norman, for inviting me. It's a great pleasure and honor to be part of the University of the Air.
I should ask about your first encounters with the vampire legends and Count Dracula in particular.
Well, you know, since I was born in the Balkans, in Belgrade, Serbia, and grew up actually in a small town of Niš that was very much surrounded by, villages, I heard those tales of supernatural creatures very early on from, my grandmother, another elderly, from that little town. So there was always a certain fear of going out at night, into the dark, going to the well to fetch water, because at that time we actually didn't have running water. We had to either go to the neighbor's yard to fetch it in buckets or, then use the well, and I was always warned, in the night, not exactly by vampires, but that there may be some haunting presence nearby. And so, it starts really kind of early on with those fairy tales and old folk legends.
Are vampires pretty much a product of that part of southeastern Europe?
As they appear in our Western culture, yes, definitely they are. But if we look at many of the cultures of the world, we find structurally similar imaginary creatures that subsist on human blood throughout the world, in Asia, in Latin America, and everywhere, really. There is always kind of a fascination with those liminal beings that kind of exist between life and death, between the living, and the dying. So for us, it in the West, it really does originate in that other part of Europe, the Eastern Europe, the Balkans, that always are somehow not quite European. They're not quite civilized. They always have that tint of being slightly wild and have an access of both violence and sexuality that makes them exotic and interesting. And that especially happened in the times of Bram Stoker and during the Romantic period, when many of those people who traveled as part of the Grand Tour to the Balkans, like Lord Byron, for example, brought those tales back. So his Lord Ruthven, who was one of the prototypes for the vampire figure, was maybe one of the first ones to appear in the Romantic imagination. And during the Romantic period, actually, there were many writers, in France, Théophile Gautier, for example, Alexei Tolstoy in Russia, who wrote vampire stories. It was almost like a test for every romantic to write his own story about the vampire.
Yes, it does seem to have just kind of cropped up quite dramatically in, I'll say, English literature in particular, and of course, the story of Lord Byron and being sort of snowbound with several friends, one of whom wrote Frankenstein just to kind of while away the time, Mary Shelley, and then Dr. John Polidori wrote a story called The Vampire, which turned into an opera by Marschner. So all of these things did seem to coalesce very quickly in Western Europe for whatever reason.
Exactly. So that famous night on Geneva Lake where Mary Shelley wrote or began to write Frankenstein and, Byron actually told a tale that then Polidori wrote down, and Byron, of course, later accused him that he stole it from him and so on. So there is a lot of literary gossip in there.
Yes, it was a group that was prone to all kinds of gossip, and I guess still is. As far as name recognition, though, the vampire, if you were to say name a vampire, I think almost all of us would say Dracula.
Exactly.
And how does that come about?
Well, of course, it comes about from Bram Stoker's classical novel, Dracula. And interestingly enough, his rendition of the vampire legend is the one that then influences, all the other later, articulations and incarnations of the vampire figure in the Western imagination. The word itself comes from the root drac, which in Romanian means the devil. So Dracula is kind of the devilish, the fiendish one. It is partly based on folklore, but it's also based on Vlad Țepeș, who was the ruler of Romania during the Middle Ages and was renowned for his incredible cruelty and strategic use of violence in his dealings with his political opponents.
Țepeș, for example, means...
Țepeș means the impaler.
It's a great kind of by name to have.
Exactly. So, he basically organized the feasts in which, he would invite guests and then have as an entertainment, during and after dinner, people being kind of impaled around him. And if people were not... cheering enough, he would impel them as well.
His guests,
yes.
Did Vlad Țepeș have, I want to say, positive characteristics about him? Was he someone who seems to have turned bad? Or what were the pressures on him as we talk about the prototype of Dracula in the Middle Ages?
So on the one hand, Vlad Țepeș was for the Romanians in the 19th century during the formation of the nation state of Romania, because he's Vlahian, which means, and that's kind of the central province of today's Romania. He was seen as a national hero, somebody who fought the Ottoman Empire and therefore affirmed primacy of the Romanians over the Turks, the Ottomans. He's seen sort of as a freedom fighter. Some say that his bad reputation came from the Saxon traders in the region, who actually were prohibited from free trade by him, and he imposed draconic taxes well, that word again, draconic, that is the root of Dracula, spread rumors about him that he was a person who, you know, feasted on human blood, that he dipped his bread in human blood during meals, and so on and so forth. So, it's really up to the interpreter to, choose which one is true and which one is not in history. But of course, what goes down in the imagination is this image of a really cruel vampire-like ruler, you know, Dracula, and images that have such potent, violent content are, of course, the ones that are gonna live on, more successfully if they're passed down in the past, and especially during that kind of Gothic period in Europe, where those tales were very much sought for and sought after in the post-Romantic period.
Vlad Tepes had what kind of family historically?
Yes. Yes, he had, and he had his younger brother, and he and his father was actually the founder of the so-called Order of the Dragon. And the Order of the Dragon was a secret society of European and East European knights from Hungary, Serbia, Romania, Bulgaria, who were joined together to fight the Ottoman Empire and their rule. So they kind of swore to, you know, give their lives and use any means necessary to not allow Turk, or as they saw it during Middle Ages as the spread of Islam, into Europe, and they fought in the name of the cross. So we have this very interesting contradiction in terms of Dracula, who is actually, as a figure, you know, a person who fights for Christianity and its legacy against Islam, but then at the same time, in popular editions of the tale, he's mortally afraid of the cross and flees, and the cross when shown it. So we have this kind of interesting contradiction there that is really hard to reconcile. And so, because I'm kind of a follower of the deconstruction, I always come to these aporias of kind of when the meaning breaks down and you have these kind of contradictions that actually envelop a figure like Dracula. It's interesting also to see that, you know, Stoker, who was basically an Irish writer, in some way, Ireland in relationship to the British Empire, of course, was in a subaltern position. So he had kind of that understanding for a subaltern person that Dracula may be. And we actually see sympathy, you know, for Dracula, you know, during the rendition of the entire novel. And he actually says that exactly in the novel, it was one of my tribe that avenged the cross at the Battle of Kosovo. And he invokes Kosovo, which is actually the main, let's say, place and a trope of Serbian nationalism. Who is it, one but one of my own race who fought at Kosovo and defeated the Turks? So again, to defend the cross, you know, against Islam, but then we have his mortal fear of the cross at the same time. So it's a very interesting contradictory figure.
And one more question about the historical figure, Vlad. Were he and his brother captives of the Ottoman Empire early on?
Yes, and some people actually attribute his cruel nature to the fact that the Ottomans were, keeping them imprisoned. Actually, it was their father, the founder of that Order of the Dragon, who gave them as a sort of token in some negotiations with the Turks that he will not break his word. And they were in Turkish captivity for several years, and they say that actually they saw such horrible torture while there that he learned the whole thing about the impalement and human torture by observing, you know, the Ottoman practices. We don't know if that's true. I'm just saying what they found.
Sure, convenient way of to kind of point the finger the other way, though, in terms of the cruelty factor. What kind of relationship did he have with his brother? And how did they get out of Ottoman captivity?
I believe that they were just like returned back, or there was like a fight with the Ottomans and they were liberated. And Radu, his brother, was considered to be kind of like what we would call today not a very manly person, while Vlad was really a manly leader, while Radu was more soft, and there were some implications that he was a homosexual. So it's a very interesting story about the two of them.
He was apparently a fairly shrewd general, though, when it comes to fighting off the Ottoman forces, and he would have had some insight into the way they would fight, I would guess, after those years of captivity.
Exactly. Because of his cruelty and this, the impalement that he used and the summary executions, his enemies, of course, he was feared. And, at that time, during the Middle Ages, of course, this was something that you can count on is psychological warfare, that people will be afraid of you.
What kind of relations did he have with Western Europe?
As I said before, what we may consider Western Europe, at the time would be maybe Hungary, that King Sigismund of Hungary, who, of course, we will not consider as Western Europe now, but at that time, if we say that, let's say that Western Catholic and Eastern Orthodox were, marks for East and West, then we could say, let's say that Sigismund was the one, and he formed alliances with them. And in a sense, they all fought together the encroaching, Islam until the Battle of, Vienna, when, they finally, managed to defeat the Ottomans. And, that started their retreat back with the help of the Polish, with the help of Polish forces. So it's very interesting that that is also the way in which we get the name for pastry that we all like to eat, is crescent shaped, the croissant.
Yes, that was a kind of defiance of the Turkish crescent. Is that where the croissant roll comes from?
Yes, when they defeated the Turks, they baked, in Vienna those crescent shaped pastry to celebrate the victory, and it stayed as a crescent, which is of course one besides the star, one of the symbols of Islam.
What about Vlad's family in terms of, did he have children? What sort of wife or wives did he have?
I'm not exactly sure, that he, had much of a family, but I know that later on, the Romanians and the Romanian government tried to, lionize him, and they even issued in the 1970s during the rule of Ceausescu, they issued a stamp commemorating Vlad himself as a national hero. And it's very interesting that Ceausescu actually, when he was fleeing the revolutionaries in 1989 at the very end of communism, actually went to Lake Snago where Dracula's castle was, and that's where he was caught and executed. So we have some really bizarre historical parallels there.
Intentional? Was there symbolism there, do you think, or just coincidence?
It just happened that way, and probably he thought he would be protected there, better, but, he met his end there.
And what happened to Vlad?
Vlad himself, we're not exactly sure, how he ended his life, it seems that he was also feeling very repentant about his actions, and he was also considered a great founder of churches and monasteries, and he gave a lot of money to churches and monasteries to expiate for his cruel acts. So it's kind of a really interesting and contradictory figure, that we have in him.
We're going to look further at Dracula and the continuation of the vampire myths and how they extend into the 21st century reputation or characterization of that part of Europe, Southeastern Europe, when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Tomislav Lunkinovich, and we are looking at vampire legends and how they affect our thinking even today with regards to some parts of Europe. And we have looked at, part legend, part history, that figure of Vlad Tepes, Vlad the Impaler. And we have also mentioned Dracula, the creation of Bram Stoker, Irish author, who wrote his best-selling novel in 1896. So we've skipped a good 75 years, haven't we, Toma, from the time of Lord Byron and Dr. Polidori, 1816, 1820, to the end of the century. Does the vampire in literature carry through the 19th century, or did Bram Stoker just kind of jump out of the blue and pick it up?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. And the real interest in the vampires really starts as a scientific one. And that's how very, very few people are actually aware of that. Because in 1725, the Wiener Almanach, which was a leading kind of a Viennese review, brought this tale of Peter Plugojevic, who was a vampire from Serbia that actually an Austrian expedition discovered as a kind of an undead person. And from there, the so-called vampire hysteria spread, throughout, in the late 18th and early, late 17th, early 19th, early 18th century, spread throughout the, the Balkans.
This Blagojevich, you referred to him as an undead. Was that just kind of a misconception on their part? What sort of person was he actually?
He, we never really find out, but there is this village Medveđa in Serbia that actually I visited, and I actually have one of my mentees now has a book out with Rutledge, who actually went and collected the legends that are currently existing in, eastern and southern Serbia about vampires. People actually believed in the real existence of vampires. And between 1725 and 1740, we have about 40 to 50 doctoral dissertations at leading European universities, from Vienna to Leipzig, but mainly in the Germanic world, that were dealing with the topic of the vampires, discussing whether they're moved by the animal soul or, by the, mineral soul or vegetative soul. We have a lot of Aristotelian, theories about bodily humors and how they move the dead body. And it was something in between theology and modern science that was born, at this moment. And so, from this vampire craze in the 18th century, we then move on to the examination and, of the folklore in the 19th, where, as you know, many of the kind of like Herder and Goethe were very fascinated by the Balkan folklore, and they collected a lot of tales, and vampire, of course, makes its appearance there. And we imagine vampire usually through Bram Stoker and the Romantics and Byron, especially, as kind of thin, pale gentleman who, doesn't eat much, as as we can see from your quote, but is subsist on a liquid diet.
But is attractive to women. Right?
But is also very attractive to women, a seductive character who has a certain, sexual powers to seduce. While when we read the original Balkan folklore, it's the vampire is described as red, ugly, and drum-like, and really reminds one of a tick, because he's so swollen, from drinking the blood of the living.
Yeah, I can see that.
All deformed. So it's very interesting how we make that kind of skip, from the lowly Balkan peasant in the local folklore to the seductive aristocrat, who in the Gothic imaginary.
Well, English majors will, of course, all get into the thing called the Byronic hero, which is, as we said, as Lord Byron was, very handsome, very seductive, and as one of his friends said, mad, bad, and dangerous to know. And so just by his very existence in his short 36 years, he may have done something to further the cause of that image of a vampire.
Exactly. And if you read about Lord Ruthven, which was his vampire, he seems very much like an Byronic hero's alter ego. He is, tall, thin, seductive, very strong in words, but of course doesn't, sup on anything but blood. So.
Do we start getting female vampires at this point?
Actually, it's interesting that Sheridan Le Fanu has a story, Carmilla, even before Bram Stoker, some 30 to 40 years before, in which Carmilla is the female vampire. And we have a very interesting kind of sexual thing going on, because her prey are, young girls and not young men. So she's kind of like a gay vampire in many ways. And Carmilla then becomes kind of an interesting figure for readings in gender studies about kind of re-semanticizing that. So, she's the one that is obviously, the first one to appear in Le Fanu's work. And then, of course, in Dracula, we have those, three vampiresses that appear in Bram Stoker.
Yes.
And then, the legend kind of, moves on to, the late 19th and 20th century, with a vamp as a seductive female in Hollywood.
Yes.
And borrows the name of vampire for that.
By the time we come to Bram Stoker again, 1896, for his still classic novel, Dracula, I thought it was really interesting what you said, Toma, about this kind of parallel between the Wallachians, Romanians oppressed by the Ottomans, as a parallel to the Irish oppressed by the English, and something that the Irish writer Bram Stoker would have picked up on as a parallel. But that is kind of an abstract concept in a way. Was there something more specific that it would have triggered Bram Stoker's interest in Dracula?
I'm not exactly sure, except for that kind of geopolitical reasoning that there would be something else, that connected him as kind of an Irishman. Although, if we read like political pamphlets, from the time, it was often that the British Empire would represent the Irish separatist movements as vampires trying to destroy the empire. And there is like a very famous, cartoon, to that effect that we actually used to read in my course.
As far as the descriptions, the settings and that kind of thing, what kind of research did Bram Stoker do to write Dracula?
I believe that, it is known that he spent a lot of time, in the British Library, researching, I think, medieval manuscripts. And I would say that he probably read a lot of, histories and those, medieval treatises on the vampire, that I kind of mentioned before. those dissertations and the fascination with, you know, the vampire as sort of this kind of liminal figure between the two worlds. So I think that he basically read a lot of those dissertations during his researches in the British Library.
And Stoker was very successful, perhaps in part by bringing his vampire to England?
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, after him, I think the popularity exploded, and we then had the appearance of the so-called, you know, penny dreadful, you know, the Boulevard Press that were, you know, sold for a penny about vampires. And it was usually an excuse. Varney the Vampire was one of the most popular ones during the 19th century. And it was usually an excuse, really, to show the semi-clad women that the vampire is attacking in the popular, you know, press. So that, you know, in this kind of Victorian society, you could only show that kind of a body, you know, with an amount of horror that is attacking it.
You couldn't make it too attractive.
Exactly.
And as far as the appetite for this sort of thing, there was a fascination, wasn't there, earlier in the 19th century with abnormal psychology? Robert Browning, for example, in some of his monologues, but Poe, of course, by the time we get to Poe, it's a lot of it about abnormal psychology. Was Bram Stoker feeding into that, or is Dracula just a different kind of guy?
Yeah, I think he was also, you know, showing sympathy at the same time as he was showing his, you know, deviation and abnormality, that he had like a really like a soft spot for him, you know.
In his neck.
In his heart. Yes. And then it is interesting to see how, you know, in many ways the Nosferatu, the first movie, you know, about the vampire by Murnau in the 1920s, actually is kind of a reworking of Bram Stoker's Dracula, and you know, how we move into the filmic imagination by actually showing some pretty disgusting creature in Transylvania.
I think Bram Stoker's wife, if I remember correctly, actually sued the producers of Nosferatu for copyright infringement. I guess she thought it was a very close reading of Bram Stoker's book, Nosferatu.
Yes, and it was, and I think, you know, they were made to, you know, they had to acknowledge her, you know, because I think the estate definitely sued Murnau, and I think they had to pay that she won, you know, in the courts in the end. But Nosferatu is also very interesting reworking of the legend, because this is the first visualization through a film camera, you know, of the Transylvania, of, you know, the wolves that howl, the yes, three vampiresses, and then the fantastic Max Schreck in the role of Nosferatu, which I think is actually being remade for launch this year, very soon. And I actually really look forward to seeing the new version and how they deal with it, because it's a brilliant, brilliant film. And if remember, Nosferatu is the one that fills his coffin before being moved to Western Europe.
Had to have the native soil, you mean?
Native soil, you know, with him. And so these tropes of the soil and blood, you know, which define the discourse of nationalism on the one hand, and the existence of a vampire on the other, that he has to have his native soil to return into, is something that actually prompted me to write my this seminal study, Vampire Nation, to use these two tropes and then kind of work through them to see how, in a sense, vampire is the obverse of the nation, the nation who always, you know, claims it's everything light and bright and the best, and then you have the vampires, the exact shadow of that, the opposite, you know, that uses violence.
We'll get into that in a second, but first I just have to ask, before we leave the vampires per se, where did the garlic and the wolfsbane and the stake through the heart, the bullet even, come from in terms of laying the vampire to rest good forever?
Forever, yeah. The hawthorn stake is the one that comes definitely from the Balkan folklore, and you can still, find people doing hawthorn stakes around their estates to protect them. This hawthorn, wow, for some reason, is thought as a protective plant, that will guard off the evil spirits, and so therefore it is directly imported, I think, from the Balkan folklore.
And the garlic,
it has many interpretations, but the garlic is kind of a natural antibiotic. And here we come to the connection of the vampire with the early modern pandemics and the plague.
Oh.
Because many people actually connect the, I don't know if you remember from Nosferatu, also his coffin is filled with rats, and rats are the carriers of the bubonic plague.
Sure.
And so many people thought that the vampire was, in a sense, an expression of an anxiety, that people will get infected by this, the deadly, disease, and that he is the carrier. The vampires actually carry the plague. They bring it about from the east.
That makes perfect sense, doesn't it? Because it, yep. Vampirism is contagious, right? I mean, exactly. Once you're bitten, you become a vampire yourself. The concept of being undead, I'm not exactly sure, unless we're talking about people who are comatose or something. Or how does that tie in?
The undead, I mean, there are, some scientific explanations, but of course, those imaginary ones are always more appealing in literature, right? So the scientific ones are, people who are stricken by lightning and then they wake up in their grave because electricity is then taken by, they're grounded, so to speak. That was one explanation, that was given. The undead, I think, are that liminality of the vampire is, something that is always appealing to the imagination, that it is a creature that always hovers between life and death, that it, can come back and, goes back at night into its coffin, and then during the day into its coffin, and at night comes out to feed and so on. And I think that's what is really appealing to the imagination. Aside from scientific explanations, that it is a creature that in many ways has kind of qualities that are associated with mainstream religion as well, because who else got resurrected in our
sure.
main religion, and that is Christ, right? So it's kind of an inverse and reversed resurrection, let's say, that we are witnessing with a vampire figure, somebody who can come back from the dead. So we have this kind of unholy figure that is mimicking in some ways through popular culture the official religion in many ways. So I think that's kind of the cultural mechanism behind it, not exactly the explanation, but there are many cases of so-called the chewing of the dead, and that is cases of premature burial. You mentioned Poe,
yes,
and he
yes.
has a story of premature burial, in which they would find corpses that had, bloody
tried
lips
to
and
claw
teeth
themselves
because,
out.
Mm-hmm. out because they were they were buried prematurely. So then they were assumed to be vampires because they saw blood on their lips and so on. So that's another kind of explanation of these undead creatures.
We'll look at how this has become a metaphor, this vampirism, a metaphor on a kind of a national characterization level. And that will take us back above ground right after this. This is University of the Year. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Tomislav Lunginovich, and we are looking at vampire legends and history and fiction as they blend together, and all of the cultural complications of vampires. And now, having done that, we're going to look at how vampires have actually cast a shadow, figuratively speaking, across a large portion of Europe, and I'll say southeastern Europe. But Toma, how do you want to define geographically this image that vampires have cast over parts of Europe?
Well, it is very interesting that, you know, we can, if we use vampire as a metaphor, as a kind of extended, you know, metaphor and allegory, and, you know, bring it about into thinking about politics, geography, geopolitics, let's say, we will see that somehow this part of the world is always tinged with this kind of image of people that are not quite civilized, not quite part of the identity that is acceptable to the West, that always carry an excess of unwanted violence within them, that they are prone to committing things that we already mentioned were committed by Vlad Tepes, for example. And so in this book, Vampire Nation, that is, you know, my study of it, I kind of try to represent and see how really, you know, this kind of a large discursive formation, let's call it, falls over the entire Balkans as the region of the vampiric imaginary, you know, that the people who, you know, are not quite, you know, civilized, you know, and are ready to commit acts that are not in accordance with our own civilization. So that very much refers to the Yugoslav wars and the ways in which, for example, Robert Kaplan wrote the book Balkan Ghosts, which he directly invoked, you know, the image of these kind of ghostly figures, you know, in the Balkans that were reawakened, the so-called age-old ethnic hatreds that were reawakened to break up the former Yugoslavia and so on, and casting the Serbs in the role of the main civilizational vampires, you know, in this process. So it's sort of interesting, and I used kind of the psychological mechanism of projections to see how Serbs, who are geopolitically really insignificant, are sort of a mask or a foil through which actually, you know, larger empires project and actually hide their own imperial desires to control that region and, you know, the whole global scene, for example.
Well, the Balkans do have this geographical situation in which you have, I'm going to say, a significantly different culture in Western Europe to the West. You have the major influence or dominance of Russia to the east, and then to the southeast, you have the old Ottoman Empire. So you have this kind of crushing effect right away, I would think, among those three entities. And then also, as we saw very much, sadly, in the 1990s, in the Balkan War, you have Islamic versus Serbian entities who are apparently in a very long-lasting kind of conflict.
Mm-hmm. At least that's, you know, how it was, you know, represented to us, you know, in the media. But of course, it was all about the, you know, strategic, you know, fight of the West to first defeat the Soviet Union, then Yugoslavia, then all the countries who were socialistic, and, you know, break them up into, you know, this insignificant units of power, let's say. That was kind of the geopolitical aim. And then, of course, all the narratives that arose with that, were used and were, had that kind of a terrible hue. Balkans is an extremely complex region because of the tapestry of nationalities that live there in cooperation and quite peacefully, and they would do so times and ages until the greater powers around them started meddling with them and trying to use them. Because you have three major religions, in one spot. You have Catholicism, Orthodox Christianity, and Islam, in the former Yugoslavia, that coexisted quite nicely and peacefully. But then, in the First World War, when Austria came, then Germany, then in the 1990s, our own United States, trying to gain the upper hand in the Cold War, was also using this conflict, to steer the things its own way. So, of course, all strategic and psychological warfare methods were used, in this process. So, therefore, we, have, for example, Bill Clinton, who decided to bomb the Serbs, for example. He actually said Balkan is not the heart of darkness, although, of course, he meant it is the heart of darkness, using Joseph Conrad's metaphor, sure, and so on and so forth. And if you are small enough and insignificant enough, many tales can be spun about what is actually going on in the region. And in a sense, we have many examples during those wars in which people of different religions and ethnicities actually helped each other, across the ethnic lines, and did not display this extremely cruel and violent behavior and so on. But of course, that's what we did not get, in the narratives, because they didn't fit, the overall narrative of, let's say, defeating communism.
So the Balkan War was actually a product of the Cold War struggle between United States and its allies and Russia. That was actually...
And the Soviet Union at the time. And then after Soviet Union fell apart, Yugoslavia was just left to its own devices. And, the U.S. helped definitely the kind of Western republics, the Slovenia and Croatia, to gain their independence, because they fell into that kind of Western Catholic, camp.
Yes, yes.
And they didn't know what to do with the eastern half, which was Bosnia, Serbia, Macedonia. The, smaller ones were easier to deal with, but Serbia was the only one that was the largest country. And because of the religion, they were immediately associated with, Russia and the Soviet Union, because of the orthodoxy that is kind of in common with the two places. And we had this kind of Huntingtonian model really strategically being used, to deal with it in this kind of clash of civilizations. And, we had to support, the Western ones and fight against, the Eastern ones. And in the process, they kind of alienated majority, of the Serbian population, who is very pro-Western. And this whole story about Russia and Serbia being eternal allies really is a 19th century kind of invention during the kind of Crimean Wars and so on.
Well, certainly,
Russia in reality never helped Serbia in any way. It was just kind of an imaginary thing in the Serbian imagination as well. And currently in Serbia, we have a government that, cannot go against that sentiment, and they didn't want to impose sanctions on the Russia, but are actually actively seeking the European Union membership and actually follow all the dictates of the U.S. So it's a very complex political situation, and I don't want to get into it right now. But
well, yes, and easily oversimplified by
exactly
by the Western press. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Back to the image of empires, though, as applied to this part of Europe, how do we see that playing out today?
you know, today it looks like from what I could gather from this new book of my mentee Professor Trbović, it's very interesting that, you know, the vampire in his interpretation are actually used as a shield, you know, to not provide anthropological knowledge to people who are actually researching it. So he's saying that peasants are actually making up things, you know, to scare you about the vampire so that you would leave them alone. That's kind of like said in a very simplified manner, but, you know, that they use the vampire story to say there are vampires here so that you wouldn't come and gain knowledge and through knowledge domination of their region, because they kind of have, peasants have innate suspicion of people who come into their world and start asking questions. So it's a very interesting thing in this part of the world.
Yes, I would think it would be a difficult thing to quantify, as you know, without taking a survey, extensive survey of the peasants, and getting them to be forthright about these stories of vampires. So do you have the sense, Toma, that in this part of the world, the part that you grew up in, that these vampire stories are still being told to children as they think about going outside at night?
I think it's quite different now. I mean, because now we have this kind of digital realm and the internet. So, you know, most of them are playing video games everywhere you go. It's quite amazing how fast this process of modernization, you know, is going on. What I see in terms of the vampire is how people are, the local, let's say, entrepreneurs are trying to use these places where we had supposedly the appearances of vampires, like the old mills on rivers, which are supposedly haunted places where vampires appeared. Or, you know, the legend of Jure Grando, very near to where I'm right now in Istria. And then create like vampire museums or create little wooden stakes that you will buy as a souvenir and wear around your neck. And creating like a cottage industry around it in order to survive. And in Romania, they even, you know, started a, you know, Dracula Land, which was supposed to be the largest theme park devoted to vampires.
Well, you could say it draws in a lot of suckers.
Exactly. And I think even some people were saying that Prince Charles at the time, now King Charles, was one of the investors, but then he pulled out when he saw what was it turning into. Because,
I think you can get tours, can't you, of Vlad's castle? Is that for real?
Yes, that is for real, and you get the tours of the castle, although that is, you know, not the original castle, but the one that he used once, but it's more accessible than the one in which he lived, which is just a barely a ruin and in a very inaccessible mountain. So, you know, that will do for tourism, I guess.
Well, thank you for taking us through the legends and some of the history behind them and some of the geopolitics behind them, too. It's been a great pleasure, Tomislav Lunginovic.
My pleasure, Norman, and wonderful to be your guest.
I'm Norman Gilliland. I hope you'll join us for University of the Air next time around. Our engineer is Lee Rayburn, and this is the News Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.